So I'm Melanie Morrison. My sister Tiffany Morrison went missing June 18, 2006. Her last known whereabouts was in LaSalle. She had left a bar there after going to see a band. It was somewhere, from what we can obtain from the person that left with her, somewhere around midnight. Her and this other individual got into a cab from LaSalle and returned back to Ganawage. The individual with her said that he got off at his house and Tiffany continued home in the cab. She never made it. When we went to report my sister missing at the Ganawage Peacekeeper's office, they took down the information but kind of didn't take it serious, which seems to be a trend with the police everywhere. They automatically assumed that people either just stayed out, decided to take off with friends and not call home. That wasn't the case with my sister, because when she went out, she has a small daughter that that lived with her at my mother's house. She always made sure to call home and let us let my mother know when she would be back and if she was gonna run late. From them just waiting to see if she'd just show up on her own caused a delay in the timeline to retrack her steps, which put us in the position now that the individual that was in the taxi can't remember which taxi it was, what the driver looks like, or anything, any details at all. Without that information, we're at a standstill, because there is three taxi cab companies in LaSalle that work that area that they left. And without any information to get a court order, they're unwilling to release any name of the workers that were working that area that night. The cab companies admitted that they know that their drivers take fares to Ganawage and don't call them in or clock them. Which we are going to be working on to find a way to make them have to call in their fare. There's a long history of different situations. If somebody takes off from the cab and taxi drivers going to the police station, giving the information where this person got out of the cab and took off, and all they want is their fare. They don't want to put a police report because they're doing it illegally off the books. And the taxi cab companies said they put out a memo asking if anybody remembers picking up my sister and said her individual to come forward. Of course, they're not going to come forward, because then they're admitting that they're doing these practices and it puts their job on the line. Since my sister's disappearance, it's been very slow going. There's been several searches done from some information. A lot of the information that came forward in the beginning was just a lot of rumors. They didn't go anywhere. Over the course of these 3 years, I've been lucky, and my relationship with the investigator that was finally assigned to my sister's case is really good and open. This doesn't occur a lot with outside police forces. It just so happens, because our police is from the community, it seems to be a little more one-on-one. Last year, I took it upon myself to try to get things in motion to get my sister's story back out there, because we were at a standstill and it was kind of like my sister was fading into the background. After a lot of inquiries and that, and how to bring my sister's story out, I decided to have a vigil for her this year on her third year anniversary of her disappearance. And that's how I came to be lucky enough to make acquaintances with Carrie Ann, dear, sitting to my left. With the help of Carrie Ann and the Quebec Native Women, we put on a vigil on June 18, 2009, the third year anniversary in my community. And from that, we started different projects. We had a billboard go up on the Highway 138 that runs through our community. It was donated by Patterson for 1 month, and since then we've been doing fundraising in an effort to get my sister's face back out there and hopefully put pressure on the individuals that either did something to my sister or knows what happened to her. In the fall after my sister disappeared, Craig and another associate asked to meet with me and asked me if I'd be if the family would be interested in having my sister put in the stolen sister's report, which was great. Somebody was finally taking an interest in my sister's story. There was no media coverage. There was no way to reach the media. It took quite some time to get them involved, which isn't right. I've spoken the last two times I spoke to the public about it, that the media needs to treat every individual, regardless of race, as equals. And if you're going to cover one person being missing, all should be covered. And when you get the phone call with the report that they're missing and the family would like them being put out there, it should be done right away. There shouldn't be that delay. As of right now, we just finished negotiations with our Mohawk Council of Ganawage, and they've agreed to let us put up a billboard, a permanent billboard, that's going to be at the cost of our fundraising that me and Carrie Ann did, and that's going to go up under 138. We're also trying to get one up under 132. These are two main veins that go into Montreal and the south, and from Montreal into out to the South Shore, and it's a long process with when you're dealing with politics and that. But hopefully, from our efforts, if this ever happens to anyone else in our community, it'll be a lot easier for the next family to get the help that they need. And that's pretty much it. We're going to be continuing every effort to continue getting my sister out there. I have a site on Facebook with my sister's story and the efforts that we're attempting and going to be trying to do to get her face out there. So if any of you want to read a little bit more about what we're doing, just log on to Find Tiffany Morrison on Facebook. And thank you all for coming out and showing an interest.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for coming out. These issues are really important, and unfortunately, they're not talked about enough. There's a fear, I know, that if we talk about it, then we have to do something about it. Well, what do you, you know, you're going to talk about this, you're going to complain about this, but what are you doing about it? I speak from experience because I started working at Quebec Native Women in August of 2006, and 1 month later, a community member, Tiffany Morrison, went missing. And I ran around the office saying, what are we going to do? What is Quebec Native Women going to do? What are we going to do? And we didn't know what to do. And the family didn't really know what to do, and didn't seem like there was a lot of help out there, a lot of information. And so I did what I thought I needed to do. I printed up some posters and put them up around and hoped that Tiffany would be found. And 3 years later, and still no word, still no information. So when I had the opportunity to work directly with Melanie, and with her family to get on board with the campaign to find Tiffany, I took advantage. I'm not the kind of person who can just sit back and just let things happen in our community, especially things that are not right. There's a lot of prejudice that exists, a lot of stereotypes that are put upon our Native sisters, and it's wrong, but it exists. And if people aren't talking about it, people are thinking about it. There's certain places in Canada where it's very common to blatantly speak out against Aboriginal women and say, oh, they're drunks, they're whores, they're addicts, they're worthless, they're a pain. And this is done commonly and out in the open. And there's places in Montreal where you don't talk about things like that, but people think it. I am a victim on a regular basis of racial profiling, of racism, of prejudice. I work for an organization that deals with this on a regular basis. I am a member of the board of directors of Projet Autochtones Québec, which a lot of people haven't heard of. And again, we're a victim of no interest by the media. We have an enormous population of homeless Aboriginal people in Montreal. And we have an even bigger population of urban Aboriginal people who are not homeless. And this is not reflected in the media anywhere. I don't see articles in the Gazette that pertain to me and my issues and my interests, but we're here. My first introduction to racism was something so simple and so benign. I started school for the first time, grade 7, at Centennial Academy, a semi-private school in NDG, which is Montreal's our neighbor. And a young boy who lived in Westmount came and approached me and asked me if I still lived in a teepee. At the time, I thought it was a ridiculous question, and I responded by saying, no, I'm Mohawk, we live in longhouses. And he actually believed this and didn't realize it was a joke. And I came home and I told my mother this, and she was shocked, because the impression that I was given growing up was that non-Native people were highly educated. Therefore, there was no ignorance. They knew everything, everything that we didn't know, and could teach us a million things. Well, I learned that I could teach people a lot of things with my little bit of education that I had off the res. The thing that shocks me the most about this particular issue is that it's so prevalent. A story like Tiffany Morrison going missing from my community is shocking. My little hometown, safe, walk around at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, unaccompanied, was just something that could be done in my community until this happened. And I realized that's not true. It's a false sense of security, that even within our own communities, there's danger. There's danger because there's these prejudice and this racism that exists. Nobody took the Morrison family seriously when they said Tiffany went missing. Everybody who wasn't inside the family, who didn't know the family directly, had an opinion. She was a young girl, she was a young mother, she got drunk and just wanted to slack off from her responsibilities and take off. The family knew that to be untrue, but nobody listened to them. Nobody took them seriously. And this happens with all our Aboriginal women. Okay, this particular woman was a prostitute and a drug user. Does that mean that she's not worth anything? Does that mean that she's not of value? And this is the message that we're getting time and time again. That no, she's not worth it. No, she's not worth investigating. And in some of the communities, some of the more remote communities, we have to rely on these peoples who pass these judgment to do the investigations of these women who have been missing for months and months. And, oh, yeah, she'll come back. You'll see, she'll come back. No, it's been a month. She hasn't come back. What are you going to do about it? Well, it's a month now. What can we do? This is the attitude that we're being met with all the time. And it's going to take a lot of people to say, stop it. This is not right. This is not the way you deal with a human being. PETA would never allow animals to be treated like this, but in Canada has a reputation for being a place of openness, of freedom. Freedom? What kind of freedom do our Aboriginal women have? What kind of freedom does a sister have who's living on the street in Vancouver and goes missing. And all of her friends, wherever Aboriginal women go, we make our community. We make our little community. It might be in the streets with other prostitutes. It might be in a house with other drug users. It might be in the city with a little book club or with a group of singers like I have made. We make our communities where we go. And when those little communities say, hey, wait a minute, our sister never checked in with us. You know, and the cops are like, oh, she's just a prostitute. She probably got high in the street. And so she got high somewhere in an alley and didn't come back. So why are you not investigating that? Is she not a human being? Does she not have value? This is my sister. This is my cousin. This is my mother. You know, my niece. These are all people that have family, that have relations. They're not just nobody. They're not somebody who just fell from the sky on this earth. They have value, and they're people. I would suggest that you go, excuse me, that you go to the Native Women's Association of Canada website. There's a link to the Sisters in Spirit portion of their website, and has pictures of these people. And unfortunately, it's not as well organized as Enfant Retour, for instance, where the website is very easy to access. These little posters have basically a little blurb about that person. But those blurbs are written by the people who knew them. You know, take some time, look at their pictures, read a little bit about them, realize that they're people, you know, and that we're people and we deserve to be treated as such, with respect. Get to know us before you pass judgment. And when I say you, I'm not saying you people who are sitting right here, I'm saying you in general, you know, and I don't want to make any accusations or make it seem like everybody's bad and everybody's horrible. No. But the people that we count on to make legislation, to do investigations, those people need to be sensitized, need to be educated, need to let go of their stereotypes. And I know something needs to happen to change these practices, because there are people who are in power, who are in positions of authority, who have been there too long and who have been stressed out or frustrated by whatever it is that's going on, and are allowing those frustrations and those stressors to not push them to do their job as well as it could be done. And I want to talk just a little bit about our jurisdictional issues, because living in a Native community is quite a lot different than living outside. Because if you're lucky enough to be like Ganawage and have your own policing unit, they have jurisdiction within the community, but they cannot do any investigations outside of the community. So in Tiffany's case, her disappearance happened outside of our community. So what our policing unit can do is limited to what the outside forces allow them to do. So we have to work with the SQ, we have to work with the RCMP, and we have to work with the local LaSalle police. And that takes a lot of red tape, it's a lot of negotiating, it's a lot of bullshit, excuse my language, but, and it's very, very frustrating. In some other communities, there's no local policing, and sometimes they'll have to wait weeks for somebody to be investigated, because the police has to come from the outside of the community. In some places, it's only RCMP, and they have a lot of cases, and they need to investigate a lot of other things that are more important than some Native girl that went missing. So I'd like to see some changes. And I hope that I'm helping you start to think about these things and what can be done. I think if everybody does a little something, you know, we can make some changes. So, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I think it's so important that we are here together, and as Carrie Ann said, talking about what is happening openly, and talking together about what we can do to bring a change, because exactly as we've heard from Carrie Ann, and we've heard from Indigenous women's organizations across the country, part of what's happening, part of the context of the violence experienced by Aboriginal women, part of the context of the failure to provide justice, to provide adequate police response, is public indifference, is public apathy toward the safety and well-being of Aboriginal women in Canada. That this is the ground on which we see the failure of justice. This is the ground on which police forces do not feel compelled to investigate to the same extent they would when it's a non-Aboriginal woman. This is the ground in which politicians, you know, don't feel compelled to make responding to this violence a priority. And so I think that to turn things around, we have to begin by changing that indifference and by demonstrating to police, to government, that we expect something different. And part of that, too, is taking responsibility. And I want to come back to this point, but I think it's really important that we look at the pattern of violence against Aboriginal women in Canada, that we understand that this is a problem of Canadian society as a whole, that the kind of racism that Carrie Ann talked about is part and parcel of the violence experienced by Aboriginal women and part and parcel of the denial of justice, that the marginalization economically, socially, and politically of Indigenous peoples in this country is what sets the context and what allows for this violence to be carried out and what allows for the inadequate response from our justice system. And I think that we have to recognize that the acts of violence, that the disappearance of Aboriginal women, the failure to provide justice, the failure to provide adequate investigation is something which is all of our responsibility to change. Let me ask a question. How many Aboriginal women in Canada have been murdered or have gone missing in the last 20 years? People may have seen a figure. There's a figure of 520. That figure is a figure which comes from the research work being done by the Native Women's Association of Canada, who have provided tremendous leadership in exposing this violence and pushing for change. But they have done their research through contact with family members, through reviewing media articles. This is the source of the information that comes up with that list. And that figure of 520 is shocking in and of itself. It's appalling to think that in a country where overall we have a small population, where Aboriginal people make up a small percentage of that population, where overall we enjoy a relatively low crime rate, to think what does that number of 520 missing and murdered Aboriginal women, what does that mean? What's the tremendous scale of that violence? And each one of those lives is a life to be valued, is a person missed by their family. I think it's so important that we began with the story of Tiffany Morrison to remind us of the individual, because if it's only one individual, that's still too many. That's a cause for concern in and of itself, a reason for us to demand action, to demand change. But the Native Women's Association of Canada has compiled a list of 520 women. But that's a list from limited sources, because that's not a list compiled by police on the basis of their records. That list is necessarily only part of the picture, and we don't know the full picture. And why don't we know it? Because the government of Canada is not counting. The lives of Aboriginal women mean so little that when they are murdered or go disappeared, their lives are not being counted. We know that police forces in Canada record the Aboriginal, whether a victim of crime is Aboriginal or non-Aboriginal, only 60% of the time. So 40% of the time, that information is not even there, even though the police information systems actually have the capacity to record that. So the information isn't there fully 40% of the time. When the information is it recorded accurately? Well, who knows, because what's the guidance that they're receiving on this? Most officers I've spoken with have received no guidance as to the importance of recording this information, what it means. Most officers I've spoken to have the understanding that the term Aboriginal is a physical description. Does the person look Aboriginal or not? And if they don't look Aboriginal in their eyes, they don't record it. Beyond that, the government is not taking the responsibility to ensure that the data that's there is collected on a national level, is shared among police forces, and is available to us publicly to make sure that the resources are going where they're needed to address the seriousness of the problem. So again, 520 known cases, how many more are unknown? We begin to get a picture of the scale of the problem, and in the very fact that the numbers are unknown, we begin to get a sense of the scale of the failure of Canada as a society, of the federal government, in its responsibility to ensure that the lives of Aboriginal women are valued and are protected. When we began work, in fact, it was 6 years ago, leading to the release of our first report, Stolen Sisters, in 2004, one of the things that stunned me was to, when we inquired about police forces, about what their missing persons policies were, to be told, this isn't public information. We can't tell you what our missing persons policies are. So imagine that you're a family member, living in fear of the fate for your sister, your daughter, your mother, going to the police to seek help. You don't know what to expect of them because many police forces in this country do not make public their own responsibilities, their own procedures. In some cases, this is because they don't have such procedures. The handling of missing persons cases is such a low priority that it may not be handled by specialized officers. It may not be handled by people who have training and experience. There may not be particular procedures for them to follow. And part of the reason it's a low priority is what we heard about, the notion that people who go missing or reported missing have simply run away and return home safely. And in fact, to be clear, that is actually what happens in the majority of cases. The fact that happens in the majority of cases, though, doesn't change the fact that in a minority of cases, something much worse has happened. When those police forces whose missing persons policies are either public or we've been able to obtain through access to information requests, for example, where we've seen missing persons policies, the most common risk factor that's named is the weather. Because the risk factors because when police are looking at missing persons cases, they're looking at a range of things. They're looking at runaways. They're looking at people who are lost in the woods. They're looking at a real range of circumstances. And the same system is the system which people who have very serious fears for the lives of a loved one also have to turn to for protection. The Native Women's Association of Canada has compiled a guideline for families to help them with this process. It's interesting, again, there was an Aboriginal women's organization that had to take on this work of making this system of policing accessible to families. Because that step hadn't been taken by others, hadn't been taken by police, hadn't been taken by government. But overall, our understanding, what we've learned, is that in the vast majority of cases, when people go to the police and all that they know is their loved one is missing, the assumption that's made is the assumption that Carrie Ann was describing, the assumption that, well, they'll just turn up again. They've just taken off. Don't worry about it. Because the systems, for the most part, are not set up to deal with the real risks. They're not set up to deal with, to understand and respond to the very high rates of violence experienced by Aboriginal women in Canada. And they're not set up to deal with the possibility that even somebody who has voluntarily broken off from their family, from their friends, who has run away from home, who is hiding from an abusive partner, who has decided that they cannot be around their family or something else and need to go somewhere else, then all those circumstances, that given this high rate of violence, that they can become a target, that they can be exploited, and they can be targeted for violence. And we need a system. We need assurance that when a family member goes to police, the police will respond based on a genuine understanding of these risks, based on genuine care and concern for the families to meet their needs. And we've called for there to be clear and set protocols for this kind of police work, and we need protocols because without protocols, the police response is based on the individual officer's understanding and assumptions and ultimately their biases. And in this work, we've talked to so many officers across the country, and I can tell you I know officers who are utterly committed to addressing the inadequacies in the system in respect to violence against Aboriginal women. And we've also talked to officers who simply don't get it. And we know from work we've done in a wide range of circumstances that there are also officers out there who are racist when it comes to Aboriginal people and cannot be trusted to make their own best judgment when a family member needs their support. That without proper protocols, without proper procedures, without proper accountability, without oversight, without training, without any of those measures, all too often family members simply do not get the help they need. I mentioned the number of 520 missing and murdered Aboriginal women that have been listed by the Native Women's Association of Canada. Another figure we sometimes use, and this is a partial figure, because it's a figure based on telephone interviews. But a Canadian government survey found in 1996 that Aboriginal women in Canada reported experiences in their families of death by violence 3 to 5 times higher than non-Aboriginal women. 3 to 5 times higher. And again, it's a partial accounting, because if you do a survey by phone, you're only reaching part of the population inevitably. So it gets a partial figure, but we know there's an extraordinarily high rate of violence experienced by Aboriginal women. We know this violence takes place in a wide range of contexts. It takes place in the home, it takes place in the community, just as it does for any woman. All the evidence points to also a particular pattern of violence where Aboriginal women are targeted because of the ways in which they have been marginalized, the ways in which their identity has been constructed socially, through the media, through racism within our society, so that they are seen as an appropriate target for violence. We know this from the accounts of those perpetrators who have been convicted of their crimes. We know from those trials and those convictions of men who deliberately target Aboriginal women because they think they deserve it. We know of men who commit horrible acts, and they don't do it as some individual sociopath on the fringe of society, but they do it in collusion with other men, and they brag about it afterward, all of which tells us that their actions, that violence, is embedded in social attitudes toward Aboriginal women. So we know that the response has to be one that deals at a societal level. We know from the stories of so many of the women who have been targeted, we know that Aboriginal women are targeted across all walks of life. And we have to be clear about that. That sometimes a phrase is used, there's an investigation in Edmonton, they talked about the phrase high-risk lifestyles. Mm-hmm. It's a really concerning phrase because it puts the responsibility on the choices made by the women as opposed to looking at our society and the choices made by our society and looking at the perpetrators. We do know, though, that women who are forced by circumstance that they're homeless, don't have adequate access to safe housing, don't have ability to provide for their families, women who engage in the sex trade, engage in the drug trade. We do know, though, that they are much higher risk because of all of those factors. They receive less protection, and they're more likely to be targeted. Again, there's a pattern there that needs to be understood, and we need an adequate response. Along with the Native Women's Association of Canada, that the Assembly of First Nations, Aboriginal women's organizations across the country, what we're calling for is a comprehensive national plan of action in keeping with the scale and the severity of this violence. A plan of action that will not only ensure a thorough and effective investigation of each and every case, but the cases that are before the police when somebody comes tomorrow seeking help, but also the cases that are buried deep in the files, because they didn't get enough attention in the first place. A thorough response in every case, but also profound reforms to the way in which the government of Canada, Canadian society as a whole, relates to Aboriginal people to address the social, the economic marginalization. To take only one example, the Kelowna Accord marked a commitment to close the gap in social and economic conditions between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people in terms of education, in terms of housing. Real basics that are protected in international human rights standards which generally in Canada most people take for granted, but which for Aboriginal people are so profoundly substandard. The Kelowna Accord marked a commitment to close that gap, and the Kelowna Accord was dismissed. In fact, the phrase I believe used by the government was written on a napkin. Well, no, it wasn't. It was the product of years of consideration, negotiation, roundtables, and debates, and the product of a First Minister's conference where First Minister sat down with Aboriginal leaders and agreed, this is a plan of action, this is what we need to do, and this is the money we need to commit to it. We're calling for a restoration of that commitment, restoration of those funds. I won't go on further except to say we did just release a new report called No More Stolen Sisters. Released it on Wednesday. It's on the Amnesty International website in English, on Amnesty, Amnesty spelled in English, .ca, Amnesty spelled in French, .ca for the French edition of the report. And I would encourage people to look at it and to take part in the actions that are attached to it.
Okay, it's working. Thanks. Thank you. Hello, everyone, and salam. It's a pleasure for me to be here today. And basically, as I was joking earlier with Carrie, I am offering the widest perspective on this thing, and henceforth, I am last. But let me start out with just the issue of language. Because I think it's really important to note the ways in which terms, concepts get defined and the power of the media in amplifying these and in actually giving us the very categories of thought that we utilize. And here I'm thinking about the missing women, the idea of missing. And it makes it seem as if these women went missing on their own. And so I prefer to use the term disappeared and murdered women, because many of them have been murdered in terms of what is emerging right now. My work in this area is actually based on a very interesting series of connections. I was working on war stories, gendered narratives of war, looking particularly at Afghan women's representations in the press. And then started doing some work with the Downtown Eastside Women's Center and a colleague out in BC, where I'm based, where I was from. And in that process, started to uncover the ways in which the media had represented the disappeared women. And one of the things that struck me was how, in fact, these women were being represented vis-a-vis the way in which Afghan women were represented. And to me, the war stories are both international, they're out there, but they're also domestic, they're very much local. There is a war against women here, and that's how I locate my research. So it's looking at these two cases side by side that sort of led me to begin to wonder what in fact was going on, what was the story. Well, since then, I went on to look, I did a 5-year analysis of the Vancouver Sun's coverage of the disappeared and murdered women, and then went on to look at 7 years worth of the Globe and Mail's coverage of the same phenomena, and then wanted to look at the way in which the Picton trial was being reported and looked at the coverage therein. So I'm going to distill in a very short and condensed way some of the things that I've observed in this coverage, which I think fit sort of typical patterns of representations in terms of stereotypes about Native people. But what I want to do is I want to take this a little bit further, in the sense that I want to go on to tease out what I think are really some of the sort of fundamental precepts underpinning some of what has already been said. First, yes, the media is the widest possible landscape, an arena in which we get to hear about the issues of that should be of concern, where issues are defined in terms of what we need to attend to. And that's very, very critical. But within that, there is also the whole issue of how race, gender intersect, and particularly around issues of Aboriginality and Aboriginal status. And this is where this sort of historical framework of my research comes in, because in looking at that, it's very, very apparent that even historically, and as my colleagues and mentors have pointed out, Aboriginal women have been represented in very stereotypical ways as squaws, as princesses of a certain, you know, as Pocahontas, for instance. So within the media, there are all of these different currents that are circulating and that go back very much to a colonial legacy. Historians like Sarah Carter, sociologists like Shirin Razak, they've pointed out how, in fact, Aboriginal women's voices were never heard. And when they were heard, oftentimes these voices were dismissed. Mm-hmm. Other historians have pointed out how Aboriginal women were placed in a position where they had to sell their bodies in order to be able to feed their families. And much of it was done under the sanction and legitimized by the state. So this is a broad context. But I keep going back to this very notion of the disappeared and murdered women, because I, coming at it from a post-colonial perspective, I'm always interested to see how, in fact, colonial powers have consistently attempted to annihilate, and if not annihilate through genocide, then assimilate through forced measures, and if not assimilate, then eject people that they don't consider to be deserving of any grace or even considered to be belonging to the nation. And so in looking at the Aboriginal backcloth of all of this, one of the things that becomes really interesting, and for me particularly since moving to Quebec, is the whole way in which the church has been involved in how Aboriginal children were taken away from homes, the way in which monogamy and Christianity was introduced, the way in which Aboriginal women's stature was actually reduced vis-a-vis men in traditional societies. All of those factors come in. And so one is left wondering that if a way to conquer a nation is to conquer its women, then that would certainly explain why Aboriginal women's lives are being erased. And in thinking about this, when I started looking at the actual reportage that was going on in the papers, there were two sides that were happening. One was Aboriginal people as militant when they were demanding their rights in terms of land claims and so forth. Aboriginal women as fitting a particular profile. And the use of this profile is very much condensed in the words high risk, living a high risk lifestyle. But also this profile has Aboriginal women as being very susceptible to diseases, as producing a lot of children, as being addicted to drugs, as being involved in the sex trade, as being inept mothers, all the custody cases that I read about very much portray that. And so you have the depiction and the representation of these women as being unsalvageable. Okay? They are seen to be undeserving. And why are they undeserving? Because they're framed as being ultimately culpable for everything they go through. In other words, they are responsible for inviting harm upon themselves, which is something that Carrie Ann also pointed out. But again, if we were to fit this within the framework of the existing realities of Aboriginal lives today, then especially in terms of as Indigenous peoples to this land, how do you actually do the Stephen Harper trick and say colonialism didn't exist? Well, one of the things you do is you turn on this frame of culpability. So you turn around and you say, well, we gave them all these chances and look, they just didn't make it, okay? The second thing that's an element over here is, and again, I'm reminded of the Kelowna Accord. If you were to compare, as I've done, the number of dollars that have gone into the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and look at the number of the money that dwindled down or was actually accorded in the Kelowna Accord, which was a fraction of that, you'd be shocked. So there are all of these other elements that are going on. I think simultaneously, because gender doesn't play in the field alone, it's relational. So if we were to look at Aboriginal men, then one has to encounter the fact that Aboriginal men are criminalized and are the majority in all of these institutions, in prison institutions right now. So if you've taken the men away and put them into prison, and you've removed the women and put them into places that are dangerous, places that are dangerous and that are constructed as zones of degeneracy by society, right? Then what do you get in terms of annihilating a nation? So all of these nations that are there are all of these elements that are in the, working in concert together. So in looking at this research, one of the things that really struck me was the notion of Aboriginal bodies as not only not salvageable, because again, when I do the comparison with Afghan women's bodies, then the issue becomes one of salvaging these women. So the rescue motif is really apparent in terms of our forces going out there, and as I've said in a recent article, helpless maidens, chivalrous knights, right? Chivalrous knights, Canadian chivalrous knights going out there to rescue helpless maidens. But in terms of the rescue motif as it's playing out here on the ground, well, it just ain't there, yeah? But the other thing too is the notion of prostitution, the profile. You know, in terms of racial profiling, this is a profile. And in fact, in the news media, because the news media are so heavily dependent on the state, such as the police, to define what's a crime. So they go to the police and they do a police beat, they go to the police station to get the news every day. So how the police frame these bodies then becomes transmitted into the press. This is not simply a sort of like a robotic kind of transmitting thing. It's more in the sense of how things get inflected and defined. So, and I'm not going to make I'm not going to defend the news and the newspaper or the journalists, but I will say that in this time of sort of, and this time has been, as far as I'm concerned, a long time. It's been about 30 years that since the economic situation has been so bad that newspapers cannot hire more people. But what newspapers are doing is shrinking their workforce. And so the workforce, the reporters themselves, are relying on these primary definers, like the courts, like the police, to actually predefine a situation. And so what we're getting is a packaged definition of the situation. And this really becomes apparent because when you think about it, in the Vancouver coverage, the whole reason why the disappeared and murdered women issue actually gained salience in the public arena was because there were four journalists. It actually started with one journalist who was very, very sympathetic, Lindsay Kynes. And he went around and started to uncover what was going on. Sure, I mean, and then he was, thereafter, the Vancouver Sun appointed two or three other people, Laurie Culbert, Kim Bolan, and together they did an investigative report that resulted in an 11-story series on these missing and murdered women. But again, how many Aboriginal reporters are there to actually tell the stories from these communities? So it becomes really important to start looking at who's telling the stories and how these stories are told. And that's been a focus of my work. It's saying, all right, sure, we have all of these negative representations of Aboriginal women. And then because of the organizing, and I would say the organizing by Aboriginal women, by groups working in solidarity with them, like these reporters, one of the things that happened was the introduction of representations that sought to humanize these women. So they became our brother, our sisters, our mothers, our nieces, and so forth, to make them seem more like us so that the public consuming this news could actually become more empathetic to the plight of these Aboriginal women. That's a move, a discursive move, that's fine, except that when I think about it, and in doing some of this work, I had one of the strategies that me and my colleague in journalism came up with was that we figured that since the reporters, the sort of size of the reporting force has decreased, the number of reporters, and since reporters don't have the time or the wherewithal to go and search for the real stories, well, one thing to do would be to actually introduce all of this material, these stories, into the alternative media, and thereby, you know, when you're clicking, as these reporters often do, they will come across this story and they will report it, or they will report aspects of it. And in doing that, I remember writing something for the TAI, which is an, I don't think it's alternative, but certainly it's an online news journal. And I began my article by saying if 500 Canadian soldiers had been killed in Afghanistan, there would have been an uproar across the country. But 500 Aboriginal women are disappeared and murdered, and there is nothing. And because it's an online journal, which I don't think I'll ever go online again, but one of the things that happens is that all of the sort of like repressive elements start to come forth, and suddenly there was this sort of rant that occurred with post after post completely dismissing what I had to say, and very hatefully, I must add, talking about my analogy between these soldiers and Aboriginal women as something that was so ludicrous and so unfounded. And how could I even compare the two? And this wasn't coming from Aboriginal quarters, okay? This is coming from the sort of like the dominant population that is looking at that is accessing this work. And by and large, this population, I would say, is middle class, educated, and white. And so it was interesting to me how much hate was generated because of that. And this idea of the soldier, the chivalrous knight, as being sacrosanct, but the Aboriginal woman as, metaphorically speaking, somebody who he stands on to achieve his fame over her body. So, and this is a metaphor that I think it really came through in this kind of coverage. So what I'm going to end up, because I don't want to go on, is that I think we also need to look at the way in which positive representations are working. So if this whole thing is like, and the discourse changed, of course, when the interventions were made by the families, by organizations and so forth, that in fact these women were humanized. But they were humanized in such a way that the context was lost. So you didn't understand the responsibility or the structural violence of society in actually forcing these women to occupy these zones. In other words, it became sort of like, well, you know, they were really good women, they just ended up in harm's way. It was nobody's fault. They were unfortunate victims, you know, being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Well, wrong place and the wrong time, by whose definition, right? Who defines what's the wrong place and the wrong time? So again, there was this total erasure of the historical background, but also the contextual background, as in why? What are the conditions that push women out of their homes and onto the streets? What is it on the streets that's there? Why are there no services on those streets? What do the streets do in terms of presenting zones of degeneracy versus zones of respectability? How do they affirm middle-class morality? Yeah, so that men from middle-class homes can go into these areas, use these women, and come back rejuvenated, and these women are left there. So I think we need to really look at that issue of these relationships. And finally, I want to add something about the statistics. The danger in looking at positive and negative representations rather than seeing how these representations actually fit into the telling of a larger story is that the statistics that ensued soon after, because of this focus that now went, the public gaze was now turned on Aboriginal women, Statistics Canada started to put out its statistics and so forth, is that along with the caricature or the stereotype of the Aboriginal woman as blameworthy, as culpable, as fitting a profile, was the way in which these statistics were used to actually underscore her very culpability. In other words, if Aboriginal women were sick, or if they suffered diseases more than the population, the average population, then they were made to be responsible for it because they were putting themselves in harm's way. if Aboriginal women were being murdered by their partners more so than the average population, well, it was Aboriginal women that were putting themselves in that way, and it was Aboriginal culture that was the reason behind it. So the culturalist argument began to surface in these stories that what's at issue, what's the problem, is not the dominant culture, not the dominant society, but rather Aboriginal culture. And there again, you see the same motifs in play as are happening even in the case with Afghanistan. It's not that Afghan women aren't heroic, that they don't transcend the struggles that they constantly are confronted with. It's more their culture which imprisons them. And so the women are left responsible for the fate that awaits them. And I'll stop there and end on this note. Thank you.